the Ball Talk Liberty Podcast. This is episode number 110 of the Central Indiana's favorite podcast. I'm Jeremiah Moore, joined by co-host Dakota Davis and a guy named Chase Payton.
What's up?
Today's episode features the very esteemed author and professor of economics at Indiana University Southeast, Mr. Eric Schonsberg. Did I say that correctly?
Eric Schonsberg.
Schonsberg, okay. We are going to be talking to Eric about mainly Andrew Yang, the Democrat presidential candidate, who is proposing universal basic income. And Eric wrote a really good paper about it, a really good article. So we wanted to bring him on to give us some more insight into this platform piece. And then we will also be talking about the city of Newcastle closing its offices on Tuesday, May the 7th, which is the day for the primary election. So make sure you stick around to the end for the little bit of local news, but we have a good show for you today.
This show is about our lives in rural Indiana. We're here to push your boundaries and make you think as individuals. Sometimes we will provoke you. Other times we'll just make you laugh. Hopefully, you'll always learn something new. Very excited to be here with you guys. Do want to send some thank yous really quickly. We're getting all kinds of complaints in the Facebook chat. I assume producer Chris is efforting very hard trying to figure out what's going on. He looks uncomfortable, so I think that means he's working. Got to thank Chris Bilbrey, Brant Spicer, Christy Avery, John Phillips, and Craig DaCosta for helping us out. Chris Bilbrey, want to give you a special shout-out. You got the interview we haven't been able to do. I was out in California last Friday, but I saw that the president, the vice president, and Congressman Pence all were together, and he actually got to meet Greg Pence. He's not just a cardboard cutout. He actually met him.
He scored the very elusive congressman that we have not been able to get since the primary election. It's been a wild roller coaster. So, Chris, congratulations on that achievement. Also, those people are on the Patreon site that supports us and helps us pay our bills for this studio. You guys are all awesome. If you want to sign up on Patreon, then the membership started only $5 a month, and that is of course how we keep this show going and how we keep it improving. Patreon.com/BossHogOfLiberty. If you don't want to support monthly, but you still feel like you should give something to the show, then we greatly appreciate that as well. You can do it on the Amazon wish list, tchip.com, which has our merchandise stores. And then, of course, we have a GoFundMe set up so that we can get a new and improved camera set up so that whenever Eric is over here and he's talking about universal basic income and he's digging down deep, then we can have a camera set right up on him and you can really get into the show. So if you want to help support that, then GoFundMe is the place to do it.
All right. We're going to let Guffy get bailed out and have Dakota go over there and figure out what's going on real quick.
Uh-oh.
With the live feed. And Chase and I are broadcasting professionals. We'll talk to Eric here for a few minutes and carry the show. No worries whatsoever.
Yes.
Chase.
What's up, man?
Welcome back.
Oh, thanks.
Your absence has been noted.
Is my suspension over?
I think your suspension is over.
Sweet.
We probably need to renegotiate your terms of employment.
Okay. More money. Give me that moolah.
We can offer to double your previous salary.
Okay.
And
deal.
You have to. The problem is you have to stop cursing. You used certain words before the 8 o'clock number, and we had an agreement.
What if I take my old salary, but I can still cuss occasionally?
I don't know. What do you think, Eric? Does that sound fair?
I'd give him another title.
Assistant to the host?
Assistant.
To the deputy.
Deputy. Regional
assistant
deputy.
To the regional manager.
You did want to be on sports. Did you prepare any sports for us tonight as final thoughts?
Yeah, I can throw something
you have draft
together.
Analysis or anything?
Yeah, Bears drafted a running back.
Okay, you brought us a welcome back gift. It looks like
Colts, such a good sports section. Yeah,
the Colts drafted some player I had never heard of.
The Colts traded out of the first round, so
sure did. Right to here, the Redskins picked it up.
Ooh, I'm going to be going to the Bears Redskins game.
Is that in Chicago?
No, it's in Washington.
Can I go?
When are you going?
I think it's mid September.
Why didn't I get an invite?
I haven't even bought the tickets yet, man.
Some of us like football. We actually
this
might
is
go.
Me telling you about it.
All right.
Oh, good news.
Why
is,
don't you ever reply in chat anymore?
He's that one guy in the group chat that contributes nothing to the group chat.
So when I got a regular amount of sleep, I still never replied in the group chat.
He stealed it.
I stealed in it. So anyways, now that I don't get any sleep, I see you guys messaging each other and I'm like, I don't care.
I see how valuable our friendship is.
I respect that.
All right. That's enough.
So hold on. So I got a cool gift for myself since I've been working two jobs, which I want to say screw all you guys that said I'd only last 4 weeks or 2 weeks or 1 week. Because I'm on like 11 weeks. We're going to say 11. I'm not really quite sure. I think it's double digits. I'm going at least 12 weeks.
What was the bet? $10?
I don't know. I
think it was
five.
The sad thing is...
We never bet more than five.
Do you have change for a 10? here's $10. Congratulations on beating the number.
Just put it down here.
Maybe you
so the sad thing is...
If you're a good guy, you donate it to Duffy.
The one that believed in me the most was Christy Avery. And you know my relationship with her. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Now I can quit.
This is so uncomfortable.
I just had to prove the point. I'm not even going to move this the rest of the night.
All right.
So I got a cool gift.
All right.
I got tickets to the Bears-Packers game, first game of the season on the 100th season of the NFL.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Is that really in cool. Chicago?
Yep.
And who's going to that game?
Me and my mom.
Not bringing the girl?
I told her I'd take her to Washington. She liked that better.
There you go. She's been to Chicago.
Yeah.
Well, very good. We're glad to have you back for however long this lasts.
Tonight.
Yeah. If you drop any more F-words your first episode back, then I'm going to have to suspend you again.
I haven't dropped any F-words yet. Does that mean I get one?
That was the warning. No. The first one, then you're off.
French toast.
We'll just have to mute you over there.
Freedom dividend. All right. So, what was wrong over on the other side? What was broken?
The microphone input on the iPad was swapped, so it was.
So we were just talking through the.
Yeah, this only the iPad was picking it up. It's fixed now. Everything's okay.
All right.
So let's talk to Eric. Eric, like I said in the Patreon portion, it's very handy whenever our guests have a Wikipedia page, whenever I'm writing the show notes. If you're a Patreon member, you get the show notes in advance, and there's a handy link on your name that leads to your Wikipedia page. I knew about you like beforehand, and then I'm reading the Wikipedia page, and I'm like, holy cow, this guy's done it all. Like
he's run for Congress. He's an author. He's a noted economist. He's got it all. Yeah. He got it all covered.
Well, and you
he used to run in the Derby as a jockey. I mean, he's done it all.
Yeah, he's a little too tall.
World's tallest jockey. Everybody,
you. But you have covered such a eclectic group of topics, and you've taught so many of them, written about so many of them. Tonight we are focusing on universal basic income or the freedom dividend, but you are an established author in many areas. We could do a whole another 2 hours just you and I talking about the book of Joshua, because you have written a commentary on that as well, I believe.
Yes.
So it's Where did you start? Where did you first find your place that you love teaching and writing?
Well, I love teaching. I think I've always loved to teach. So, whether it's board games or bridge or two-stepping or economics, so I think there's just something in me that just loves to teach. When I ran for office, same thing. I mean, it was an opportunity to teach and have a nice forum.
When you're running for Congress as a libertarian, it's a messaging platform, yeah. Right? I mean, you probably weren't going to beat Barron Hill or Mike Sodrill.
Right.
But it was an opportunity to teach.
Yeah, I told people it would take a second tier miracle for me to win this thing. But I knew it was an opportunity to talk to people and talk to people about the issues. So
you did so well, President Bush had to fly in to yes. save those guys against you.
Yep. One little thing I won't know, I guess, until heaven, but the Republicans never talked about Planned Parenthood funding until I ran on that topic. So, and it was Mike Pence who actually made it an issue. He made it an issue, unfortunately, in 2010, I think it was, when they lost control of the House and couldn't do anything with it anymore. But if I had a quiet moment with Mike, I would want to know, you know, did me bringing up the issue in 06 and 08, you know, taking taxpayer money to give to Planned Parenthood, that didn't used to get talked about, so I may have had a little contribution there.
If Mike Pence ever comes on the show, we'll ask him.
Yes, and he may not know.
But. It for a long period of time, you and I talked before the show about the influence we've had as running libertarians or running as libertarian candidates. And a lot of our times our ideas get stolen, right? A number of things that libertarians have advocated for over the course of the Libertarian Party, have become public policy, and not because libertarians were elected, but because the ideas won.
Right.
So that's another area where you govern.
Freedom of marriage, ending the war on drugs,
sometimes
immigration reform, things like that.
Sometimes not bombing people is popular, depending upon who's not in
office. Stop using my tax money to kill people.
A great historical example, I forget which year, I think it's 1928, that the Socialist Party, their entire platform became law within the next decade in the New Deal. And so I always take that as a bit of an inspiration. You know, you don't yeah. have to win anything. I mean, the Socialists have never gotten more than a million votes, but they were able to influence policy tremendously. So, yeah, I mean, it'd be nice to win a lot, to build the party, all those things. But the fact is people just don't pay that much attention to politics. It's a rigged system. I mean, we really have an uphill battle in a lot of ways. But if we can influence the debate, I think it can make a big difference.
And when you get on the stage and you get on the platform, it's some places and some races, you get treated differently. Right. You know, in Indiana, thankfully, we have ballot access as libertarians, but we also have automatic, because of the Indiana Debate Commission, any statewide debate that's out there, our candidates for governor and Senate get included. Congressional, it depends upon who's organizing a debate. Sometimes if a local media outlet is there, they'll include the libertarian candidate. Sometimes they won't. It's case by case situation.
Yeah. So you'd asked about writing also. So that's another opportunity. So you know, you were talking earlier about Rex writing those articles and Absolutely. How much that helped the local parties. It's obviously a great opportunity to raise awareness of certain issues. So for a long time, I've written, you know, books and journal articles and kind of the official stuff, but I've always had my fingers in the op-ed, you know, pile as well. Cause I think people read that stuff. It can influence the debate, and it lets people know we're out there and get some thinking about stuff.
And right. with your position as an educator at IU, you're very likely to get published. And I know just in April, you had one on college admissions that was very, very influential or interesting. And then the one that probably got you booked today, is this conversation about the freedom dividend or universal basic income.
Yeah. So how many papers
do you get published in on average? If you send something out, is it 10 or 20, or is it a lot of the local small paper, like the county papers?
I send my stuff through, there's an organization called Indiana Policy Review Foundation out of Fort Wayne, and they distribute all the local papers. So I think it's dozens that we get into. So occasionally we get into, say, the Indy Star, the Courier Journal, Business First. I had a Wall Street Journal article like a decade ago. That was a lot of fun. But it just gets sent out, and you know, every once in a while I'll get a Google hit, you know, yeah. saying my name popped up in Spencer, Indiana or something like that. So I think it shows up in lots of places.
So the Wall Street Journal, you didn't try to get it in there?
No, we did.
Okay, you submitted it to them and asked.
It was actually on the property tax thing back here in 2007. So the Wall Street Journal wants either quirkier things or things of local interest that can be a national story. So the property tax fight back in 2007 was a big deal.
Right.
That's what we've built our model on. Local issues and national impact. That's exactly what the show has
Wind farms.
Evolved into.
So, I think, you know, I love being a teacher. I teach vocationally. I teach as a career. And there's a discipleship curriculum that we put together. And you know, one part of that is working with people to become teachers. And sometimes they will say, well, I'm not a teacher. And I'll say, well, first of all, you don't know what you're going to be in the future, what God might do with you. But second, we're all teachers.
Yeah. You know, and how do you know? What does that mean?
Yeah. Right? We're all teaching kids. We're teaching right now. And so we should become better teachers as libertarians. It's not just a matter of, you know, knocking on doors. I mean, all that stuff's important, but we need to get more effective at explaining ourselves to people. And that's what the heart of teaching is. So teaching and writing, I think, are both opportunities that if we'll, you know, work on it and get better at it, we can have a greater influence.
The reach of it, I feel very blessed to be in the era we're in now, or we can have an idea and start a podcast, mm-hmm. and people are listening in their cars as they drive across the country, and they're watching on their TVs right now with Facebook Live, and they're watching with YouTube, and you know, and there's just so many different platforms to consume this. It's phenomenal. And it's peer to peer. It's not filtered from the top down from two or three networks anymore. Now it's everybody is a network and everybody has a communication platform. Yep. Do you get the reach necessarily? No.
Before, you know, you had to write a book and then you waited on your fellow scholars to write a response to that book in a separate book. Right. And now we just get online and we go, your idea is stupid.
Yeah. And the bad news is there's so much out there, right? So if you can't,
you feel like you get drowned out sometimes.
So it's, there's more competition and competition is a good thing, but it does make it more challenging.
The quality, reaching a certain level to stand out is difficult. So what is it like as a writer now? If you write a book, are they self-published?
I've done both.
Yeah.
Really if you're, you know, unless you're going to hit it big, even the mid-sized publishers, unless they're going to promote your work, it really doesn't make much of a difference. So it really is self-promotion at the end of it. And, so I've self-published quite a few things, in terms of books, and then you just get exposure where you can.
And you just start sending boxes of books to Amazon and cross your fingers and see how it all shakes out.
I mean, without reviews, I mean, it just doesn't go anywhere, or radio appearances or things like that to, you know, or speaking, you know, you have opportunities to speak at conferences, that sort of thing.
So what's the current book right now? What are you peddling?
The discipleship stuff. We've had this discipleship curriculum for 16 years. The initial program was 21 months long. People study about 5 hours a week, meet weekly to talk about what they've been studying, small groups of 12. But there's a whole process behind it where you're trying to take someone from a new believer all the way up to someone who's a disciple of Jesus and an effective disciple maker. And what does that take to be, an elder in a church, or to lead a group of ninth grade boys and answer questions in, you know, legitimate fashion instead of diverting attention to baseball or something? So there's this whole process.
A really big problem in the modern church, especially more conservative churches. They don't know how to talk to any youth about really like the serious problems that they're facing. Because it's got such a stigma of being awkward or uncomfortable. Yep.
Right. So the Bears took a running back, huh?
I got to see Dakota Davis preach a sermon before he became an atheist.
I'm not an atheist.
I know.
How dare you? I call myself a Reformed Messianic Jew.
Wow. That's quite a mouthful there.
It's a very complicated.
I would have always just called myself a Quaker until I took an ancestry test and realized that I'm 12% Ashkenazi Jew. So
wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now it's messianic, right?
So we have a book called Enough Horses in the Barn, and it's about that process, because you talk to church leaders and we're like, do you have enough competent people to help you lead in ministry? And they're like, no. We're like, well, how are you going to get enough horses in your barn? How are you training them up? And so, but back to reviews, we had a review in World Magazine, and all of a sudden, boom, 100 copies get sold. And so, you know, and then that generates other activity. But without that review, you know, that's I wouldn't sell those 100 copies. So,
right. So you, okay. This was interesting from your Wikipedia page. You have a PhD from Texas A&M in economics, right? But you did your dissertation on determinants of congressional tenure and term limits.
Yes.
What did that dissertation look like?
Yeah, so I was really fortunate, again, very providential, to have a dissertation advisor who looked at what I was interested in, which was public choice economics, which is the marriage of political science and economics, out of George Mason University. They had the Nobel Prize winner. So he kind of looks at my background, and he's a labor economist. So he's trying to figure out, how can I apply labor economics to something that'll interest this student? He did that for all the students in his class. He picked topics. And so we dove in, we started doing research. And so I was applying these statistical methods to try and analyze how long people were staying in Congress. And the punchline of it, I looked at term limits. We eventually turned into what's called the culture of spending hypothesis, which is the longer people stay in D.C., do they tend to vote for more spending, which is pretty interesting.
That's interesting.
And that's part of the motivation for term limits, right, is that the longer you stay, if you become acculturated to spending more, maybe we should send you home earlier.
Yeah.
Right? But the coolest, I think the coolest result we had in there was the federal election campaign reform in 1974 had promised to make things more open. And what we found instead was, not surprisingly, it made it harder for challengers. It put limits on what they could spend, right? The stuff we talk about all the time now. And so the first four terms, representatives were coming back at an 80% clip. And then after the reform, it went up to 90%. So they became a lot safer after the reform.
Okay.
And so that was the kind of the cool result. But they were basically rigging the laws, yeah, whether they knew it or not. They were basically rigging it in a way that made it harder for them to be replaced.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Is that published anywhere online?
Yeah. So that's, there's academic papers back in the early 90s. That was some of my first publications.
You just Google your name and there are so many different writings and topics that come up. I really liked it. Like, you, it's a shame that you live so far away. Otherwise, you'd be on here much more often. You need to go visit your son at Ball State more.
Well, so, Justin Stevens, who I'm sure you're familiar with, he's in the chat and he says the first yard sign he ever had was an Eric Schantzberg
Congress
sign.
Justin cut his teeth in my campaign. We were talking about Christianity. We ended up talking about politics, and he's gone on to a nice career with Americans for Prosperity and some other stuff. But Justin's a good buddy.
The as we were talking, a headline I saw this week came to mind. Kristen Gillibrand is running for Senate. There's 22 Democrats running for president right now, and we're going to talk about Andrew Yang and one of his policy proposals. But once again, before we went on the air, Eric and I were saying everybody's got these new. When there's such a crowded field, you have to have a reason, a hook, something that makes you stand out, whether it's raising money or having the background or the resume or these policy positions that will hook you. And Kristen Gillibrand, the senator from New York State. She's wanting to change public election funding, and she's going to raise taxes to do this, to fund it, but basically give you, every individual in the country, a $600 voucher that you can give to any candidate you want to pay for elections publicly.
What is interesting about that is actually something that Andrew Yang brought to the table first.
Did he?
Yeah, talking to except his was $200. He wanted to give $200. To every American citizen over the age of 18 that was going to be voting, and they could give it to
it's like a voucher or a token system,
a political candidate. But the difference between the two of theirs is Andrew Yang says you can give it to any candidate. So you could give it to Chris Guffey for City Council Ward 3 in Newcastle. You didn't have to give it to a national candidate, right? So
I'm running.
So if we decide, okay, we're going to completely eliminate any sort of corporate, and the only money that we can put in, there's no PACs, there's nothing but individual donations, and we're going to have hard election reform, and the only thing you can do is an individual can do $600 federally, that's it, and there's nothing else out there. Okay, you got my attention. I can get behind that, and I can understand
reform
it.
That.
But it's not your money, right? That's the hook. As I'm reading the article, and I'm like, holy hell, this proposal is they just give you $600 federal dollars and you pick anybody you want to give it to. Yep. So that's the problem.
It is wild.
That's the Wild West. You had my attention and then you crushed my
story. My favorite comment on that story was a gentleman that said, how about we just have a system where every person gets to write down the name of the candidate they think is best.
That would never work.
Wow, look at that, huh?
You're only allowed to have, there's only two names allowed. There's the Democrat name and the Republican name, and that's it by the time you get to decide.
So you, Eric, I guess because of my specific interest in the more Old Testament theology, mm-hmm. I wanted, and you did that commentary on the book of Joshua. Yes. I wanted to know if you see any overlap between your economic views, which you have your PhD in, and of course your writings in the biblical sphere.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, my faith is really important to me. I mean, Jesus has just changed my life. I would be, I'm sure, a solid citizen, but I'd be a bit of a jackass as well. And so he's rubbed a lot of rough edges off. So, really thankful for that. And, so that's, it's crucial to my life. And then I've got my vocation and my interests, all these things. And of course, religion and politics go together. You know, when I talk in public, sometimes I say we're, you know, we're going to talk about religion and politics, and if that gets boring, we'll talk about money and sex after that. And of course, the joke there, right, is that religion and politics never gets boring.
Right.
So how do you put those things together? And what you find is Christians and non-Christians, whatever, again, people just don't think that much about politics. They have this dog's breakfast kind of set of views and a little bit of religion and kind of, you know, they're mowing their lawn and then they hear some story about Gillibrand. They're like, yeah, that sounds pretty good, you know, and that's kind of how people do it. And it's just this dog's breakfast of just garbage. And then you get, you know, Christians, for example, who then take, say, the scriptures very seriously or have a certain aspect of God as justice or something, and if they're very serious about it, well, then it's easy to make some basic mistakes like, well, that's wrong, so there ought to be a law against it. Or that's right, so let's mandate it, you know? Let's take care of the poor. We're commanded to take care of the poor, therefore...
The force of government should be the way we do it.
You know, you shouldn't have lap dances, therefore there should be a law. So it's
problem
really
with legislating the morality.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you just... And that's not just a specifically Christian problem, but Christians are fairly prominent in that. And so as a Christian, it was really important to me to figure out, look, what is the role of government? And I was becoming a libertarian at the same time out of kind of a standard GOP background. And the war on drugs, I think, was the biggest one for me. You know, Mark Twain said, if you're going to swallow two frogs, swallow the biggest one first. And so the war on drugs is a big frog. I mean, once you swallow that one, you're like, okay, you know, anything goes pretty much after that. But I just couldn't make the case, you know, all the costs that are imposed on innocence by the war on drugs. I was like, I just can't advocate that as a Christian. I can't tempt that inner city kid to deal drugs. I can't, you know, cause unrest in Colombia because of my views. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Furthermore on that, I think that you have people who get thrown into this system of maybe they are a small time weed dealer or something because they need more money. They've hit a rough place, or they've been dealt a rough hand, or what have you, and then they get thrown into our legal system, and all of a sudden they're in prison with rapists and murderers and true violent criminals, people that we are afraid of, so we put them in cages. And this guy is like, holy crap, I was just selling a plant for my house, and now he has to become the violent criminal in order to survive in that type of environment.
Yeah. I think our three biggest policies are our welfare, education, and the drug war. And they really go all together. I mean, with welfare policies, we'll pay you money if you have kids and you're not married. Okay, great. So now we're setting up a lot of single parent households, which causes, you know, the data are very clear. I mean, you can escape from that, but it's not a good way to raise kids.
Right.
Generally. Now we'll put you in a government-run school system with tremendous monopoly power over people with few resources and some family struggles, and good luck to you, right? So a lot of people escape with a ninth-grade education. And that will tempt you with, you know, you can sell drugs at age 15, or you can work at McDonald's if you wait another year. And it's just too tempting. And then we'll throw you in prison. And so if you look at, you know, what government does...
By the way, we're going to steal 20% of your money when you start going to work.
If you happen to escape legitimately.
Yeah. If you go to McDonald's, we're going to take your money.
Yep.
But if you just go sell drugs to your buddies, you can,
it's tax-free.
You can be an entrepreneur and nobody knows about it.
Yep. So I just think when you start thinking about from a Christian or Jewish, any kind of perspective, right? God is a God of justice. And especially in the Christian tradition, protecting the marginal is really important in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. The alien, the stranger, the poor, the marginal, the widow, and the orphan. And so when you have policies that are just trampling the marginalized in society, that's unacceptable. And so, you know, just thinking from a Christian perspective, what is the role of government? What should government quit doing to harm so many people? And so that just became, you know, an obsession. I don't know. I was like, I have to get this straight in my head. What should government be doing?
And many times, there's many times where you have a great idea, right? You know, this is what we like in government. This is what they should do. We should outlaw murder, whatever the goal is. And ultimately, for libertarians, it comes down to force and fraud. So if there's violence involved, that's where government needs to get in that space. But otherwise, it should be left to the private sector or individuals to work these things out for themselves through property rights or mutual associations or just through individual conflict.
I've got another essay coming out next week. It's entitled The Meatloaf Theory of Government. And it started with me thinking of two out of three ain't bad. And that when I ask people, you know, when should the government get involved? It's got to pass three tests: constitutional, ethical, and practical. So it's got to be in line with the Constitution. It's got to be ethical. So back to your point about force and fraud. When should I use the government to mess with you? Well, force and fraud. And then practical, I think a lot of people skip this step. Even if it's constitutional and ethical, if it's not going to work, don't do it. And with the government, two out of three wouldn't be that bad, but usually the government gets none or one out of three. So I advocate the meatloaf test. You know, if we could just get two out of three, that wouldn't be too bad.
Meatloaf, Chase, was an artist.
I love meatloaf. Like, not the artist, but just the food.
With ketchup on it, yeah.
Meatloaf is one of my favorite foods.
Guffy, are you familiar with Meatloaf, the artist?
Do you not like me?
I love meatloaf. I was going to agree with you.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite foods. Meatloaf, the artist, is just okay.
Yeah. Bad out of hell. There's good stuff there.
So I'm thinking with a meatloaf test, right? So back to teaching and writing, I'm really happy with that essay, right? Because that's going to be an earworm for the people that read it. They're going to be singing that song and they're going to be thinking of that essay that
two
I wrote.
Two out of three.
But back to your point, I think, you know, government, people aren't thinking about the ethical part of government. When is it cool for me to bring the force of government down on you? Right. If you're eating too much pie, if you're a Jehovah's Witness, if you're raping somebody, right? I mean, where's that line where you go, okay, it's time to bring the government in? And then this practical test, when is it going to work? Because people are all the time imagining government programs as they hope they'll work, not as they're actually going to work.
So many times for me, it becomes, I've got a lot of friends that are in law enforcement, our local city police department, our sheriff's department, and in the filter I use is it worth putting them in harm's way? Mm-hmm. Is this activity so important that they need to be in conflict? Because ultimately, anytime we pass an ordinance or we pass a law, it leads to violence because they are where the rubber meets the road. And that's where we have to be sure, you know, is that $25 seatbelt ticket really that important that we need them? You know, the sheriff sent something out in our community this week saying, hey, we're going to step up enforcement. We're going to create these situations of conflict where we're going to put them in, you know, you don't know what's going to be inside of that car. You don't know how they're going to react or what's going to happen. You know, if we have a code enforcement, we're going to have somebody show up and they're going to, you know, eventually the sheriff has to serve that. I know that they sign up for it and that's the responsibility and that's the reality of the job. But if you can avoid putting people in that situation because it was an unnecessary policy, then let's side with that. That's right. That's the filter I use very often. And I think it's somewhat simple to understand.
Yeah. I think we can get better at asking those kind of questions of people, you know, and some people will respond more to the ethical part of it, the force and fraud point you made. Other people, they don't share our values on that. Right. They're perfectly fond of helping you live your life.
If you're not doing anything wrong, you have nothing to worry about, right?
Those kind of people.
Yeah.
So then I think you go with the practical arguments. Okay. How's this really going to work and try and score points that way?
Very good. Dakota, what's going on over there, buddy? We haven't done a show in over a week and it's starting to feel like it.
The video connection keeps
we're having Mevo
going
issues.
Out, but we're fine with the audio.
We're gonna have to start
Gonna keep going.
We will not start all over.
No,
we're a podcast first. The video is it's a bonus. And 90% of the time it works every time.
There was a update that was available for the Mevo camera and
we chose not to because when we take the update, usually it breaks two other things.
No, usually we're okay with it. With the update, they usually give and take something away, but we didn't update this time, and I think that is a problem. I think that they don't like the fact that we didn't update, so they're just not going to let us stream.
So,
but we're okay, and we're going to graciously and smoothly transition into
whatever Chase is trying to do.
Eric, what's your favorite book of the Bible?
Oh wow!
The Book he wrote of Mormon. A commentary on Joshua.
I thought it'd Yeshua. Be Joshua, but I wanted to ask:
is that how you say? Is that how Joshua is in Hebrew? Yeshua.
Yeah.
Is that it? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yep.
As far as I know. Wow. I would have to pick Genesis. I think it is so
it's
rich.
Got a bunch in there.
What is yours?
Philemon.
Philemon. Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Only because I went to a Christian school like all my life. And I read this.
You're the one guy here that went to Liberty University. I mean, you've got street cred.
You
do
have street cred.
I also
got kicked out of Liberty University. So, I read this kid's book when I was little, and it was loosely based on the Book of Philemon. So I've just always liked that one. But I have several favorite books of the Bible.
My favorite is Book of Job. Yeah, because I'm also really big into Stoic philosophy, and that is the Book of Job is the epitome of. Of reacting it with reason and not emotion is
we joking. Play this game where Dakota mispronounces words he's read, and I try to pretend. Did you mean epitome?
What? I said no. The epitome.
Am I the only one? I'm looking around.
It's epitome.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, there's not a word.
Huh. It's all right.
Really?
I've heard people say epitome, and I'm pretty sure it's been Dakota every time.
Has it?
It's a great word, but.
That's all right. He does
this like once a month, and I go, "What? How did you get this far in life?"
There are a lot of things that I write down and I read, but I never say out loud.
Mm-hmm. This is confession time.
What?
I was a young boy, and I didn't know any better.
And your father took you into the city?
No.
See marching band?
I read my very first book that cussed, and I didn't know. How you spelled the word damn. So I'm reading this book and I'm like, damn. I didn't know. I was so confused. Yeah. So I understand, but I learned when I was about 8. So the fact that you're 24 years old and we're having this conversation now,
I literally thought that epitome and epitome were two separate words.
Well, what do you think epitome meant?
I thought it was like the adjective version. I thought they were like this, they had the same definition, but they were used in two different contexts.
Brian Regan does a really funny thing on Hooked on Pahonix. Trying to do a commercial for that.
So. Ah, I like that. Yeah. That is me. Yeah, that's for sure me.
The yellow one is the sun.
I'm bad with words.
All right. Well, that made my night. So thank you. If you can't beat up on your friends, we need a good clip
of that. I think because whenever that happens, I'm like, I don't know that I've ever said this. So I think about it first, and I'm like, I'm just gonna say it like this, and then I get called out, and I'm like, that was wrong. But that time, I legitimately had no idea what you're talking about. Whenever you called it out,
I'll be honest, I was like 50-50. I was like, I don't know if that's a word.
So you were like epitome, and I was like, no, different word, man.
The best part is we were in each other's weddings, right? We've got this connection now, and I know when I've got him on the hook, and it's fun. Made my night.
Had no idea. I'm never going to be able to get that right because you've been saying it
a certain way so long.
Yeah.
Damn, man, I don't know.
One more thought on Genesis, because I can tie that back into family. I mean, when you're reading Genesis, you realize that God's trying to work out family stuff. I mean, it's sibling rivalry all the way through. He's got Abraham. You know, if you get to the end of Genesis, it's a nation, or it's a nation about to be. But it's as if God's saying, look, if I can't get the family right, I can't get the nation right. And so I think that's a really important consideration that, you know, we talk about politics, but culture, society, you know, we could have, you know, if we don't get family right and all the problems that go with that, then all this other stuff is just, you know, window dressing.
Yeah. Nothing else matters if you can't start there. All right. Let's transition gracefully.
So when's the commentary on Genesis coming?
Might be inspiring. Abraham's what I hope to write on that.
I believe the R.C. Sproul, he did commentary on the whole Bible, and I think that Genesis is two or three really large books. Yeah.
Andy Horning annotated the Constitution. You could always annotate the Bible. I know Ken Ham worked a lot on Genesis. But.
two chapters of it. That's all he cares about.
All right. Andrew Yang. This is the column that came out a couple weeks ago, probably 3 weeks ago. Andrew Yang is I guess they're calling him an entrepreneur, younger guy. He's probably the second youngest fellow running as a Democrat amongst the 22 major candidates. And he came up with this plan. He adopted this plan. I don't think any idea.
It's been around 50
new.
Years.
Yeah. And this goes, is this Rothbard goes back all the way back to, or Friedman?
Friedman, maybe before that. But
And basically it is, from the, on the libertarian side, we've said this is where you eliminate the welfare state. You completely get rid of
or transform it.
Or you transform it. So instead of having individual programs, we just universally, every adult gets a check. No matter if you make $1,000 a year or $500,000 a year, the plan that Yang has is anybody 18 years old and over would get from the federal government $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And we'll link to a version of it. You're saying anybody 21 years and older, you actually think this has got some, it holds water.
Yeah. I mean, we'll talk about Andrew Yang because I think he's worth talking about. Charles Murray has a nice little book on this. That's actually how I got into it. Our econ book club on campus, someone suggested the book and the idea. I'm like, okay, let's do it. And it's like a 90-page book. It's a very easy read if you want to check it out. I should have remembered the name of the book, but if you just Google UBI and Murray, you'll find his book. So I definitely recommend that. It's interesting to think about how do you motivate it. There's lots of things. I mean, the first thing to say as a libertarian is this is all conditional on us being in the welfare game, right? So I'm not advocating welfare as a libertarian per se. I'm just saying, look, if we're going to do this, if government and society has decided we're going to do this thing called welfare programs, this is a much better way to do it. So just make sure the caveat is out there that I'm not advocating the UBI in a vacuum. I'm just saying in the context we find ourselves
in the pragmatic world where libertarians hold zero seats in Congress. Right.
This would be a great improvement. Yeah,
this is a directional solution.
I think the other thing, Yang has this analogy. He talks about how people in Alaska receive a dividend from oil, right? Yeah. And so they receive a check. And I think that the economist lingo here would be a positive externality, that if society is producing all these positive byproducts, you spill those out to people. And I think you could motivate it from economics that way. Yang's concern specifically is about technological advance and what that's doing. And he has greater concerns than I have about the pace of technological advance, but he sees this as a true safety net for people that he envisions being displaced. So he cites the truckers, for example, and just imagines that in the next 5 years, there's going to be hundreds of thousands of jobs gone. And I that's not the way markets typically work. He could be right, but I'm not nearly that apocalyptic, but that's where Yang is coming from. To be really excited about this issue.
He is equating this coming the robotic or technological revolution, so to speak, to the Industrial Revolution, right. Which, of course, we know was in some ways catastrophic. In some ways, you could make the argument that it led to the direct rise of the Soviet Union and not adapting to this modern era. So he's worried that that's going to happen in the United States.
That's possible. But
more violently because there's more people with more to lose.
Right.
He does cite the truckers a lot. He cites all the people in fast food, retail workers.
In our area, the manufacturing base, right? We've seen, once again, as we were talking before the show went on the air, we should really just record the whole place anytime there's a conversation around here. If we just bought ourselves an Alexa, it would all be recorded by Amazon for our benefit. The city of Newcastle, our community, is an old UAW town. So there used to be thousands of jobs with Chrysler here. Those jobs have moved outside of this area for different reasons, modernizations, labor contracts, other markets being able to service those jobs better. You don't need as many hands doing it. All of these factors are what leads to the thinking about a universal basic income.
Yep.
Yeah. Go ahead. I was just going to say that Yang does make the point that the American truck driver or trucking companies are the largest employers of high school educated men in the United States.
Yeah.
So that is a huge portion of the population. I mean, I think probably everybody in this room knows at least one or two truckers, right? It is an extremely common profession, and he does have legitimate concerns. If all those go away, then it's like the Twitter joke of learn to code, right? Yet you're going to tell a high school educated man that's been driving a truck and all of his life to all of a sudden learn something as complicated as coding or something to do with technology. It's That seems unrealistic from a real pragmatic point of view. And
so the question is how quickly are markets going to do that kind of adjusting? And his concerns are greater than mine on that. You know, the markets are going to adjust. How much is the question there? But I just want to make the point that's what's motivating his concern on that policy issue. And I want to say a couple other things about Yang because we may get off of him pretty quick. He's worth listening to. I mean, he is a policy guy. And I mean, anymore, it seems like both major parties are more about power and politics than policy. So I appreciate anybody who's going to talk policy. So yeah. I deeply appreciate what Yang's doing. And the other thing is when you hear an interview with him, he belly laughs. And the first time I heard it, I was surprised that I was surprised. And then I realized politicians don't laugh. And so I'm just like, I like that about this guy. So he belly laughs and he's into policy. So he's easily, to me, the best Democrat out there. Charles Murray is also interested in UBI. He put out a book about 12 years ago, and then there was a 10th anniversary edition that I picked up. His concern is twofold. One, he's written about welfare policy for a very long time and the detrimental effects on all sorts of incentives for work, saving, family, et cetera, the impact on individuals, the effect on communities. His book, Coming Apart, I think is necessary reading and what's happening for the classes, lower middle and middle versus above and what just how things are shaking out there. So he's very influential there. But then also he's looking at just the growth of entitlement spending and that it just doesn't work, you know. And so if we're, you know, his angles are welfare and the unsustainable amount of spending. And so if that's the case, he says, look, we're going to be forced to do this. You know, maybe Yang's right, but
$22 trillion in debt.
So the debt, the entitlement spending, the baby boomers retiring, welfare spending, you know, Medicaid, Medicare, on and on.
Is in the Yang proposal, is he eliminating Social Security with that 12,000 a year?
Yeah, he allows everyone, him and Murray both, I think, have an important provision, which is an opt-in provision. So no one's forced to this. So Social Security would not disappear overnight. It would disappear 40 years ago, right?
Yeah. The only people that would not opt in right away to the universal basic income idea are the people that are like the seniors that are already on Medicare and they've got their Social Security checks coming. They are obviously not going to opt into
that's
this,
fine.
But
we continue to support them.
Once they are out of the way, then.
I've said for years, if you let me out of the Social Security program, I'll make that deal today. I'm 35, 36 years old.
I'd
make the deal today. If you let me out right now, you can keep everything I've put in and I'll save my money.
Murray makes the case that the rate of return is so lousy that someone even into their early 50s is going to typically make that trade-off. Yeah. But he says, you know, politically, we have to give people a choice. So Murray gets there through concern about welfare policy and concern about just the growth of government and says, look, UBI is cheaper. And this is where the libertarian gets a little excited, right? So we're like, man, long-term, this is really nice. Even short-term, you're telling me it's cheaper to do this, and that's got to make a libertarian happier.
Right, and the reason that it is cheaper, I have a couple of numbers here in the show notes that right down here in the universal basic income section, the total spending on the average family on welfare, it comes to about $168 a day from the federal government. The total amount of money that they receive from in welfare packages is about $25 a day. So what the argument on Yang's side and Murray's side is, we are cutting all of this overhead, right? There's no more of the bloated bureaucracy. It's not flowing through all these different channels before it gets to you, and thousands of people have to be paid before it gets to the people that need the money. So we could actually do this. One of the things I wanted to touch on was how Yang plans to actually pay for this, the freedom dividend that he proposes, and it was a value-added tax, interesting.
Yeah, Yang wants to not cut as many programs, therefore he would have to add a tax. Murray is wanting to get rid of all the programs, and then you don't have to do the new tax.
Yeah. So the value-added tax is something every time you take – in manufacturing, every time you add something, you add value to something, you add an additional tax. And it's a European model. And we've talked – it's been discussed and never been seriously discussed as a public policy, but it's been discussed for – replacing the income tax, perhaps.
What I found was that, and this is all from Yang's policy pages, because you go to the man's website, like we were talking earlier about the policy side, is it's just pages of super, super detailed policy, even down to his views on circumcision are on his website. And his view is, I don't like it, but you can do what you want. It's right. Like, why is that on your website?
Just do it, people.
There's 22 Democrats. Sometimes you need a tiebreaker. I don't know where Elizabeth Warren is on circumcision.
There's a great video on YouTube.
Just do it.
Chase just doesn't want anybody to feel weird in the locker room.
There's a great video on YouTube.
I don't want that eye staring back at me, okay?
And the
this is what Dr. Eric Schonsberg signed up for today. Yeah. Right. And drove 2.5 hours north for Chase to...
The man who has a PhD in economics from Texas A&M wants to hear about Chase's views on circumcision.
And we promise that we're going to have fun.
Anyway, there's a great video on YouTube about... and it is Andrew Yang versus Pete Buttigieg on policy. And it is basically Andrew Yang going through like countless interviews of his policy proposals and then Pete Buttigieg going, I'm a gay man.
Like his whole thing.
It's hilarious. I've thought about posting it a few times. But anyway, what I found on Andrew Yang's website is that 160 different countries in the world already have a value added tax. Europe has an average value added tax of 20%, and he is going to propose a 10%. So half of the European model.
The income tax started out real small too.
No, I'm totally not in favor of the value added tax, but I just wanted to put
that would be a deal killer for me. I mean, I don't want to do that any more spending. I don't want to, you know, this has to replace virtually everything except for the opt-in provision. So I'm not a fan of that.
But the thing is whenever you're looking at candidates, and especially ones like Yang, who has such detailed policy proposals, I think you need to look at them and think about what's the debate going to be like, and how is this specific piece of legislation going to be formed by the public debate and the debate in the Congress of how this actually gets implemented, if it gets to that point. And I think that Yang, listening to him in interviews and looking at his website and everything I know about him, is that he's got this sensible approach, and he's got this open-minded approach to where, so I'm going to start out with this robust proposal, and then things are going to get whittled away as I learn how it can actually be added into American culture.
Yeah, one thing that he doesn't catch, which really surprises me, I can't remember if I put this in the essay or not, but he's concerned about all these jobs leaving. Well, if you cut all the bureaucracy.
He did put this in the essay, yeah.
Yeah, you're going to lose a lot of bureaucratic jobs.
There's federal guys that are on the curb, right?
So it's just funny that he's, you know, kind of apocalyptic about all the truck drivers, but he's not, doesn't seem to catch the fact that you have all these government workers, and government workers can be productive doing other things. Insert your own joke here, maybe. I don't know, but many of them would be productive, and so think of the people writing code to do the things you're talking about. I mean, whatever, there's a range of productivity in the government, and it'd be kind of nice to free that up. But there is an apocalyptic element of his proposal, and that for him and Murray, that he would eliminate a lot of those jobs.
Okay, so think about they could always go and work in other places for the government, because if all of a sudden we do have entire fleets of millions of driverless trucks, then our infrastructure is going to have to vastly improve. And
we have to regulate the hell out of those computers. one other topic that I wanted to cover, or facet, Dakota.
Facet of that, yeah. Two separate words, man.
One water comes out of, and one is a perspective. One other facet of your column, Eric, is that the disincentive for making more money is gone.
Yeah.
If you put this in, no matter how much money you make, you're going to get this $10,000 or $12,000 a year. So right now, you have an incentive to have a single income home, or you have the incentive to not make too much money, or else you start to go backwards economically and you penalize yourself. In this case, everybody gets it, and you still have the incentive to work that extra job like Chase and do whatever it takes to get $15 shoved down your shirt. That's the fascinating part of this, is it's not encouraging
as
quote
much.
Unquote bad behavior.
Well, it still does a bit. So economists talk about two things. I won't give you the technical terms, but if I just give you $10,000, I'm disincentivizing you to work.
Yep.
Right. So economists call that an income effect. If I hand you a bunch of income, you're not as likely to work. So that part doesn't go away, but you have that right now. So that's a wash. So the gain is when you quit taking money away from people when they earn more money. That's the problem. So with the current system, the take back rate for government averages 80 to 90%. So if you earn $1,000, the government's typically going to reduce your benefits by $800 to $900. And there are many cases where your benefits are reduced by more than $1,000. We'll take your health insurance. We'll do whatever. And so that provides, that's a tremendous disincentive that we're getting rid of. The income effect part stays. If I just hand you cash, I'm still disincentivizing you, but that stays the same. It's that take back rate, getting rid of that or reducing that, that we get economists and I think libertarians excited.
Yeah. One of the things in your article that really peeked out at me was that towards the end of the article, you say that this would incentivize, or Murray rather makes the argument that this would incentivize two parent household structures. Can you dive into that?
Yeah, same thing. I mean, you know, the current programs are set up where, okay, if you have a kid and you're married, I'm not going to give you anything. But if you have a kid and you're not married, I'll give you money.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, it's not like that drives all of that decision, but at the margin, that's going to move people to not forming families or breaking up families. And he talks about how guys will live off the women because they know that they have the monies coming in. And so the UBI frees it up, right? He has a really interesting section where he says, look, if the guy receives X dollars and everyone knows he receives X dollars, that changes the way you look at him and that you expect him now to contribute. Because before you go, well, I don't have a job. Well, you have a freedom dividend. And so he argues there'll be this change of expectations, but at minimum, you're taking away the disincentive for family formation.
Right.
What's the logic in the amount per month in the freedom dividend? Is that bringing you up to the poverty line? Because I know when the fair tax was talked about 10, 15 years ago, they would untax you up to the poverty line. $12,000 a year for an individual doesn't really get you to that point, but is that equate to an average spending or what you would expect to be paying in a safety net? How do they arrive at that number?
Yeah, Murray just uses that as a round number. And then he also throws in catastrophic health care, which is interesting
for
the dynamics of that. So he says it's $10,000 plus $3,000 for catastrophic health care. He doesn't want it to be a lot. You know, the other thing is we're talking about federal programs. So if a state says $10,000 is not enough, a state would be perfectly fine to supplement however they see fit. If they want to do their own food stamp program.
The state of California can have any program they want
right.
to. So they could go another $10,000 or they could have food stamps. Or
And maybe high cost of living states, you know, say, well, we're in Massachusetts, the state government will kick in. But at the federal level, we're just doing $10,000, keep it simple. And then it'd be adjusted by inflation after that.
All right.
Fascinating.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Yeah.
I think the other thing that's really important, and this is a difference between Yang and Murray. Yang argues it should start at age 18. Murray's very careful to say age 21. That you don't want people
the new
to graduate
age.
From high school and start getting $10,000. That's
right.
That's not a good idea
and,
for...
And the argument is that...
I could have had a lot of fun with that.
That's
well,
the point.
And that's the argument is that a lot of bad habits, stupid decision making, happen between the ages of 18 and 23. Usually, actually, I'm right on the end curve of making stupid decisions.
Oh no, I'm in my mid 30s. I still consider stupid decisions all the time. I'm just lazier and don't do them.
There goes my hope. Say sorry to my wife.
So
be like this forever,
Chase. You're not a policy wonk, right? We've never established about you.
He works too
I did
often.
Consider studying politics my first year of college. And
what?
Then I was like,
you did?
No.
You wanted to be a politician.
Yeah.
What would $12,000 in automatic money coming to you mean? Would that change your life? Would you do things differently?
Would you quit your second job?
No. But it'd help out.
You wouldn't quit your other job?
I'm going to quit my other job now. But I don't think it's going to, like, you're not going to be able to live on $12,000, right. But it'll help you out.
That's what he says too. I mean, a lot of people might work part time and kind of live on 10 plus five. Okay. That's not ideal, but it's better than what we have now.
In theory, you might have more entrepreneurs come out of this, right? Mm-hmm. You've got a little bit of a safety net. So if you're in your 20s, you're 22, 23, maybe you will start a business. And so many people work in a job because it comes with insurance. Mm-hmm. This is the conversation to start to have as we have of this single payer conversation that from the Liberty side, we're not particularly in favor of this, but your health insurance since World War II has generally been tied to your employment.
Yep.
So you don't have the incentive to start something on your own. Dakota, you don't have the incentive. I don't have the incentive to start my own business, and especially if you have a young family on the way or if you already have a young family. You're living in some fear that, man, I've got this job now and I've got security, so you're not going to take that risk.
Right.
If you're 23, you don't have a family yet, and you've got catastrophic health insurance and you've got 12 grand a year, you could try some stuff and you're going to be okay. Yeah. You've got that opportunity.
Yeah, you're married, so now all of a sudden you have $24,000 a year and, you know, I've thought about it a lot because I've said multiple times on this show that my childhood dream was to become a traditional type blacksmith. Like, that's what I've always wanted to do since I was 8 years old and went to Connor Prairie.
And a YouTube celebrity.
Yeah, and a YouTube celebrity.
Well, we checked that box.
Yeah, I'm already there. So, but I first learned about this. I'm like, so wait a minute. I'm getting $1,000 a month no matter what. My wife is getting $1,000 a month no matter what. And would that open the door for me to, okay, I'm actually going to stop my day job and work on the thing that I think would be the most fulfilling in my life and try to make an actual living to replace my income now off of that. I think that there's a lot of people like that in the world. So I don't know.
Yang, I know Murray, and I think Yang also make a case for kind of a lowercase e entrepreneurship, that people would be more likely to move where jobs are.
Mobility.
So that's another big point they make, that, you know, we have areas that are depressed and areas that are doing fine, and we're like, why don't you just move? Well, it's not that easy. I don't have any money. I don't need networking. I don't have any whatever. But if I had this safety net, people would be more likely to go. So I think you can make the case that it lubes the system a little bit and gets people some of the fixity out of it, and people can actually move a little more easily.
So one of something that's interesting about that, the Indiana Talks Internet Radio Network, which I don't know if we're on there on the weekends or not anymore. I haven't kept up with it. But anyway, they posted an article that was written today, and the title of it was called Midwest Exit. So it was a play on Brexit, and the author of the article was talking about a lot of young people have been leaving Indiana and surrounding states and going to the coastal cities, California, Boston, New York City, wherever, and trying to make it out there because there's smaller companies. They feel like they can be more creative, what have you, and they. The author of this article cited a study from Indiana University that said that the amount of labor in the workforce is projected to be less than that, exactly 50% less than what it was in the mid-1990s in 2030, I think is what the projection was.
In Indiana?
In Indiana, yeah. And so the argument was, because this author put out multiple polls on different social media sites and said, if you left, why did you leave? If you have stayed, why did you stay? What they found was left for more opportunity, could pursue my creative goals, blah, blah, blah. And why I stayed, they were saying stayed because of I have a mortgage, I'm in debt, my job has health care. All not very good. Like I just love Indiana.
Yeah. You know, like,
it wasn't that.
You hope it'd be family or climate. Yeah,
exactly.
Or something,
and it was all like,
I can't leave.
I can't leave. I'm stuck here because of these reasons. So it's interesting that you brought that up, between both of the policy proposals, because I think we're seeing that, especially in these flyover states. Mm-hmm. So, for what it's worth.
It's just going to make Indiana even even more depressed.
You're going to put $12,000 in my pocket? I'll take it.
I don't think it would make me more depressed. I would still live in Indiana.
Not individuals. I'm saying that you could theoretically have more people move to Florida or Arizona or places that have, you know, Texas, places that the economy is moving, growing faster.
I love Indiana. Warmer I love the places. State. I love everything about this
I
state.
Believe Indiana, or not Indiana, I think Indiana University put out a county by county map this week of population growth or decline. And it's really based upon, you know, Indiana as a whole isn't growing. Every county isn't growing, but the major municipal areas are what's growing. So Louisville's growing. Chicago, to an extent, is growing. Lake County isn't, but Porter County is. And Indianapolis and the surrounding area are growing. But the state, you know, the rural areas, it's not carte blanche that everybody's growing, all 92 counties. Henry County actually is trending upward, which is an amazing thing. And not by much, but we're actually gaining population right now.
We've seen some more industrial growth over here.
We've seen things trending up. Illinois has been struggling, but the state of Indiana has been moving up. But it's not the whole state. It's individual pockets. So it's just an interesting conversation. And you look at a major policy like this, and it could – this is one of those once in a generation changes, maybe once every century changes if this happened. You know, a lot of the policies that we work with now, that we talked at the beginning, the top of the show about the socialists, 1920 and the New Deal. This is the kind of thing you're talking about. It's the modern version of that.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about what it would be like to just, let's say 30 years from now, not have any Social Security, that's radical. And so if this gets us to a world like that and less expensive and the safety net that Yang's concerned about, you know, I mean, to me, it's a,
are the kinds of steps we're going to have to take at some point. I've had a discussion, you know, when I served on the Memorial Park board, our biggest cost was labor, and costs associated with people that we had have on staff or had on staff. Legacy costs are something that corporations have been able to get rid of over time with the switching from pensions to 401ks. Government has not done a good job of that.
Yep.
And that's the big looming cost that's out there. In fact, government has taken them on and has taken responsibility for them. I would much rather see us just bite the biggest bullet ever and borrow ourselves up to our ears and buy out every single public pension and every Social Security and get out of that business and be $55 trillion in debt, some ridiculous number, but stem the bleeding, pay it down, and then everybody controls their own individual. That's way too radical to happen, but on a county-by-county basis, I mean, that's the kind of thing when a company is sold, you get an offer on your pension, right? And you get bought out. That's what happens in the private sector. That's so the kind of major step that we need to take from the public policy side. Mm-hmm. And you do that, and all of a sudden you're not screwing over the next generation as bad. Those are the kinds of things that I want to see happen. But that's as extreme as, you know, that's not the art of the possible. That's the dream.
Yeah.
Don't you agree, Chase?
So is this
wholeheartedly?
is this like talking about the Freedom Dividend or UBI? The Freedom Dividend is a pretty good spin on the name, I think, but
that's Yang's title for it.
Yeah, the Freedom Dividend is what he's calling it now. Is this the most exciting proposal that you're seeing in the upcoming 2020 presidential election?
Yeah, I I'm just thankful for any talk about policy that's meaningful,
real
and not
and
just
substantial.
A tool to just beat people in the head with.
Just think about how much money you'd have if Gillibrand's thing passed and you got $600 for every libertarian in the state.
Yeah.
Of free government money.
If it would change anything.
Of government coupons.
It's funny when you hear him talk about, you know, getting money out of politics like that's ever going to happen. So,
yeah.
That's a pipe dream.
Money is speech.
So this this portion of the show talking about universal basic income is going to be it is right now, if you're listening to it, a We Are Libertarians daily episode. So appreciate you, Eric, for talking to us about it. If you are listening on the We Are Libertarians daily portion of the show, then you can check out us at BossHogOfLiberty.com. We are a local podcast in Newcastle, but we like to say we are local stories with a national impact. Of course, this one was obviously much more national than local, but appreciate all your expertise that you brought to this subject for sure, Eric.
Yeah, glad to